Cabby!
Capital, my dear Watson. Let us return to our humble abode.
221B Baker Street, please, Cabby.
From London, we present A Study in Scarlet, a play for radio in three parts by Michael Hardwick, based on the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. A Study in Scarlet, Episode 1.
Stamford, I found it. I found a reagent which is precipitated by hemoglobin and by nothing else.
Dr. Watson, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
How are you?
How do you do?
You've been in Afghanistan, I perceive.
Now, how on earth do you know that, Mr. Holmes?
Never mind.
It was many years ago, but I shall never forget that fateful meeting in the laboratory at Bart's Hospital. I was home from India, invalided out of the army, and looking for lodgings in keeping with my pension. Holmes had just found a suite of rooms at number 221B Baker Street and wanted someone to share them. I'd been warned he might prove a strange companion. And so he did. I became more and more curious about him. And, of course, he quickly noticed it.
I trust, Doctor, that these few weeks have not proved to you that I'm too difficult a fellow lodger after all.
Oh, far from it, Holmes. I don't mind admitting you puzzle me, though.
Puzzle you?
Well, the way you work like a fiend sometimes, and at others you lie on the sofa there, hardly uttering a word or moving a muscle from morning to night. And there's those curious visitors of yours. In one afternoon, a grey-headed, seedy fella looking like a peddler. Then an old white-haired gentleman, a fashionably-dressed young girl, and a railway porter. Then that little sallow, rat-faced fellow Lestrade, who'd been here three times in a single week.
Well, I have a trade of my own. I suppose I'm the only one in the world. I'm a consulting detective.
Consulting detective?
Here in London, we have lots of government detectives and lots of private ones. When these fellows are at fault, they come to me and I manage to put them on the right scent.
Oh.
Lestrade is a well-known detective. He got himself into a fog recently over a forgery case and that was what brought him here.
I see. And these other people?
Oh, they're mostly sent on by private inquiry agencies. I listen to their story, they listen to my comments, and then I pocket my fee.
It's simple enough as you explain it. But Holmes, I don't really think that... I say, That fellow down in the street, I wonder what he's looking for.
Oh, you mean the retired sergeant of Marines?
Oh, now that really is going too far.
Oh, well, we shall soon see. He's coming to our door. You know, the trouble is, Watson, that there are no crimes and no criminals these days. What's the use of having brains in our profession? I know well that I have it in me to make my name famous. No man lives or has ever lived who has brought the same amount of study and of natural talent to the detection of crime which I have done. And what's the result? There is no crime to detect. Or at most some bungling villainy with a motive so transparent that even a Scotland Yard official can see through it.
A person to see you, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Hudson. Come in.
Letter by hand for Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you.
May I ask, my good man, what your trade may be?
A commissionaire, sir. Uniform away for repairs.
And you were...
Sergeant, sir. Royal Marine Light Infantry, sir.
No answer, sir.
Very good, sir. Good day, gentlemen.
Good day, son.
Well, I'm blessed.
Now, how in the world did you deduce that?
Why, even when he was down in the street, I could see a great blue anchor tattooed on the back of the fellow's hand. That's Mac to the sea. He had a military carriage, however, and regulation side whiskers. Mm-hmm. There we have the Marine. He was a man with some amount of self-importance and a certain air of command. You must have observed the way in which he held his head and swung his cane.
Yeah.
A steady, respectable, middle-aged man, too, on the face of him. All facts which led me to believe that he had been a sergeant.
Wonderful.
Commonplace. But I said just now that there were no criminals.
What?
It appears that I am wrong. Look at this.
What?
Would you mind reading it to me aloud?
What is that? Oh, yes, certainly.
My dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, there has been a bad business during the night at 3 Lauriston Gardens off the Brixton Road. A man on the beat saw a light there about 2 in the morning, and as the house was an empty one, suspected that something was... it was amiss. He found the door open and in the front room discovered the body of a gentleman, well-dressed and having cards in his pocket, bearing the name of Enoch J. Drebber, Cleveland, Ohio, USA. There had been no robbery, nor is there any evidence as to how the man met his death. There are marks of blood in the room, but there's no wound upon his person. We are at a loss as to how he came into the empty house. Indeed, the whole affair is a puzzler. If you can come round to the house any time before 12, you'll find me there. Yours faithfully, Tobias Gregson.
Gregson is the smartest of the Scotland Yarders. He and Lestrade are the pick of a bad lot. They have their knives into one another, too. Oh. They're as jealous as a pair of professional beauties. There'll be some fun over this case if they're both put upon the scent. Come on, get your hat.
You wish me to come?
Yes, if you have nothing better to do.
Oh, splendid.
Here you are,
Kevin.
Thank you, Governor.
Well, I must say, you don't seem to be giving much thought to the matter in hand, and all that talk in the cab about Cremona fiddles and the difference between a Stradivarius and an Amati.
No data yet. It's a capital mistake to theorize before you have all the evidence.
Well, you'll have your data soon.
Aren't we going in?
All in good time, Watson. Let us first observe such important details as the roadway. The pavement. And the grass fringe. Yes, that is interesting.
Mr. Holmes, it's very kind of you to come.
Inspector Gregson, this is my friend Dr. Watson.
How do you do?
How do you do, son?
I've had everything left untouched.
Except the pathway up to the house. If a herd of buffaloes had passed along, there couldn't be a greater mess. No doubt, however, you had drawn your own conclusions before you permitted this.
Well, I've had so much to do inside the house, Mr. Holmes. My colleague, Mr. Lestrade, is here. I've relied upon him to look after the path.
With two such men as yourself and Lestrade upon the ground, there will not be much for a third party to find out.
Well, I think we've done all that can be done. It's a queer case, though, and, well, I know your taste for such things.
Did you come here in a cab, Gregson?
No, sir.
Did Lestrade?
No, sir.
Then let us go and look at the room.
Good morning, Mr. Holmes.
Good morning, Lestrade. I think you've met Dr. Watson.
Of course, at your rooms.
Yes, how do you do?
This case will make a stir, sir. Beats anything I've seen, and I'm no chicken.
You found no clue?
None at all.
You're sure there's no wound? There are splashes of blood all over the place.
Do you want to examine the body, sir?
Yes, just a quick look, I think. Well, that seems to be all. Just a sniff at his lips. And a glance at the soles of his patent leather boots. Well, I think I've seen everything I need to see. He's not been moved at all.
No more than was necessary for the purposes of our examination.
Then you can take him to the mortuary. There's nothing more to be learned.
Right. Let's have the stretcher.
Hello?
What's that?
Well, it's a ring. There's been a woman here. It's a woman's wedding ring.
Well, this does complicate matters. Heaven knows they were complicated enough before.
You're sure it doesn't simplify them?
Simplify? All right, you can take him away.
Yes, sir.
Come, Gregson. There's nothing to be learned by staring at the ring. What did you find in his pockets?
Gold watch and chain, gold ring with a Masonic device, gold pin, bulldog's head with rubies as eyes, cards of Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland, corresponding with the EJD upon the linen. No purse, but loose money to the extent of £7.13. Oh, and two letters. One addressed to E.J. Drebber and one to Joseph Stangerson.
At what address?
American Exchange, Strand. To be left till called for. They are both from the Guion Steamship Company and refer to the sailing of their boats from Liverpool to New York.
Have you made any inquiries as to this man, Stangerson?
I did it once, sir. I've had advertisements sent to all the newspapers, and one of my men has gone to the American Exchange, but he has not yet returned.
Have you sent to Cleveland?
We telegraphed this morning.
How did you word your inquiries?
We simply detailed the circumstances and said that we should be glad of any information that could help us.
You didn't ask for particulars on any point which appeared to you to be crucial.
I asked about Stangerson.
Nothing else. Is there no circumstance upon which this whole case appears to hinge? Will you not telegraph again?
I've said all I have to say, Mr. Holmes.
Mr. Gregson, I have just made a discovery of the highest importance, and one which would have been overlooked had I not made a careful examination of the walls.
Oh, Mr. Lestrade, and what is it?
Look here, on this wall. Oh, now stand there. I'll strike a match. Look at that.
What does it say? I can't quite see.
R-A-C-H-E. Rach?
What do you think of that? The murderer's written it with his or her own blood. You see this smear where it's trickled down the wall? That disposes of the idea of suicide anyhow. Hey, why was that corner chosen to write it on? I'll tell you. You see that candle on the mantelpiece?
Yeah.
It was lit at the time, and if it was lit, this corner would be the brightest instead of the darkest portion of the wall.
And what does it mean now that you have found it?
Why, it means that the writer was going to put the female name Rachel, but was disturbed before he or she had time to finish. You mark my words, when this case comes to be cleared up, you'll find that a woman named Rachel has something to do with it. All very well for you to laugh, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. You may be very smart and clever, but the old hound is the best when all's said and done.
Oh, I really beg your pardon, Lestrade. You certainly have the credit of being the first of us to find this out. And as you say, it bears every mark of having been written by the other participant in last night's mystery. I have not had time to examine this room yet, but with your permission, I shall do so now. Now, where's my lens? There. I think that will do.
20 minutes that took you, Mr. Holmes. I could have spared you the trouble in 5.
They say that genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains. It's a very bad definition, but it does apply to detective work.
What do you think of it, sir?
Oh, it would be robbing you of the credit of the case if I were to presume to help you. You're doing so well now that it would be a pity for anyone to interfere. If you let me know how your investigations go, I shall be happy to give you any help I can. In the meantime, I should like to speak to the constable who found the body. Is he here?
Well, no, he's off duty now.
Then can you give me his name and address?
Oh, yes, sir. His name is John Rance.
Rance?
You'll find him at 46 Audley Court, Kennington Park Gate.
Kennington Park Gate. Thank you. Come along, Doctor. We shall go and look him up. Hmm. Oh, gentlemen.
Yeah?
Yeah? I'll tell you one thing which may help you in the case.
What's that, sir?
There has been murder done, and the murderer was a man. He was more than 6 feet high, was in the prime of life, had small feet for his height, wore coarse square-toed boots, and smoked a Trichinopoly cigar. He came here with his victim in a four-wheeled cab, which was drawn by a horse with 3 old shoes and 1 new one on his off foreleg. In all probability, the murderer had a florid face, and the fingernails of his right hand were remarkably long. These are only a few indications, but they may assist you.
If this man was murdered, how was it done?
Poison. Oh, one other thing, Lestrade.
Yes?
Don't waste your time looking for Miss Rachel. Rache is the German for revenge. Come along, Doctor. I have a telegram to send.
I'm coming home.
Now that I've sent my telegram, we can go and see this Constable John Rance.
You amaze me, Holmes. Surely you're not as sure as you pretend to be of all those particulars you gave?
There's no room for a mistake. The very first thing which I observed on arriving there was that a cab had made 2 ruts with its wheels close to the curb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, up to last night, we've had no rain for a week, so that those wheels, which left such a deep impression, must have been there during the night. Since the cab was there after the rain began, and was not there at any time during the morning, I have Gregson's word for that.
Mm-hmm.
It follows that it must have been there during the night, and therefore that it brought those 2 individuals to the house.
Well, that seems simple enough, but how about the other man's height?
When a man writes on a wall, his instinct leads him to write about the level of his own eyes. Now, that writing was just over 6 feet from the ground. It was child's play.
And his age?
Well, if a man can stride 4.5 feet without the smallest effort, he can't be quite in the sear and yellow. That was the breadth of a puddle on the garden path which he had evidently walked across. Patent leather boots had gone round, and square toes had stepped over. There's no mystery about it at all. Is there anything else that puzzles you?
Well, the fingernails and the trichinopolis are gone.
The writing on the wall was done with a man's forefinger dipped in blood. My glass allowed me to observe that the plaster was slightly scratched in doing it, which would not have been the case had the man's nail been trimmed. I gathered up some scattered ash from the floor. It was dark in color and flaky, such an ash as is only made by a trichinopoly. I flatter myself that I can distinguish at a glance the ash of any known brand, either of cigar or of tobacco.
And the florid face, then?
Ah, that was a more daring shot. Though I've no doubt that I was right. You mustn't ask me that at the present state of the affair. There is much that is still obscure, though I've quite made up my mind on the main facts.
Mm-hmm.
As to poor Lestrade's discovery, it was simply a blind, intended to put the police upon a wrong track by suggesting socialism and secret societies. It was not done by a German.
Oh.
If you notice, the A was printed somewhat after the German fashion. Now, a real German invariably prints in the Latin character, so that we may safely say that this was not written by one, but by a clumsy imitator who overdid his part.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it was simply a ruse to divert inquiry into a wrong channel. I'm not going to tell you much more of the case, Doctor. You know, a conjurer gets no credit when once he's explained his trick. And if I show you too much of my method of working, you will come to the conclusion that I'm a very ordinary individual, after all.
Oh, I shall never do that. You have brought detection as near to an exact science as it ever will be brought in this world.
I'll tell you one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Patent leathers and square toes came in the same cab.
What?
And they walked down the pathway together as friendly as possible, arm in arm in all probability. When they got inside, they walked up and down the room. Or rather, patent leather stood still while square toes walked up and down. Yeah. I could read all that in the dust, and I could read that as he walked, he grew more and more excited. That's shown by the increased length of his strides. He was talking all the while and working himself up, no doubt, into a fury.
Yes.
Then the tragedy occurred. Well, I've told you all I know myself, for the rest is mere surmise and conjecture. We have a good working basis, however, on which to start. And now we must hurry, for I particularly want to visit Constable Rance in Kennington. Let's go find a cab.
Yes, what is it?
You are Constable John Rance?
What are we? Who wants to know?
My name is Sherlock Holmes. Inspector Lestrade said I could find you here. It's about the business at Lauriston Gardens, Brixton Road.
I made my report at the office. Can't a man get a bit of rest when he's off duty?
We thought that we should like to hear it all from your own lips.
Oh, well, I shall be most happy to tell you anything I can, sir. Come in, gents.
Thank you.
Sit you down on the sofa, gents. What was it?
Just let us hear it all in your own way as it occurred, please.
Very well. My time is from 10 at night till 6 in the morning. 1 o'clock, it began to rain. And I met Harry Murcher, who was the Holland Grove bin. We stood together at the corner of Henrietta Street a-talking. Well, presently, maybe about 2, a little after, I thought I'd take a look around and see that all was right down to Brixton Road. I was strolling down, thinking between ourselves how uncommon handy a forage and hot would be, when suddenly the glint of a light caught my eye in the window of that same house. Now, I knew that them two houses in Lauriston Garden was empty, on account of him that owns them won't have the drains seen to, though the very last tenant that lived in one of them died of typhoid fever. So, I was knocked all in a heap, but seen a light in the window, and I suspected something was wrong.
When I got up to the door, all was quiet inside, so I went into the room where the light was a-burning. There was a candle flickering on the mantelpiece, a red wax one, by its light. I saw...
Yes, I know all that you saw. You walked round the room several times, and you knelt down by the body, and then you walked through and tried the kitchen door, and then...
Where was you hid to see all that? Seems to me that you knows a good deal more than you should.
Here's my card. No, don't get arresting me for the murder. I'm one of the hounds, not the wolf. Mr. Gregson or Mr. Lestrade will answer to that. Go on, though. What did you do next?
Went back to the gate and sounded me whistle. That brought Murcher and two more to the spot.
Was the street empty then?
Well, was as far as anybody that could be of any good goes.
What do you mean?
I've seen many a drunk chap in my time. I've never seen anyone so drunk as that coat. He was at the gate when I came out, leaning up against the railings, and I was singing at the pitch of his lungs about Columbine's newfangled banner and some such stuff. He couldn't stand far less help.
What sort of a man was he?
No common drunk sort of man. He'd have found himself at the station if we hadn't been so took up.
His face, his dress, didn't you notice them?
I should think I did notice them, seeing that I had to prop him up, me and Murcher between us. He was a long chap, a red face, the lower part muffled round.
That'll do. What became of him?
Well, he didn't have to do that, looking after him. I'll wager he found his way home all right.
How was he dressed?
Brown overcoat.
Had he a whip in his hand?
A whip? No.
He must have left it behind. You didn't happen to see or hear a cab after that?
No.
Well, there's half a sovereign for you.
Oh. Thank you, sir.
I'm afraid, Rance, that you will never rise in the force.
Uh-huh.
That head of yours should be for use as well as ornament. You might have gained your sergeant's stripes last night. The man whom you held in your hands is the man who holds the clue to this mystery and whom we are seeking.
But I tell you...
There's no use arguing about it now. I tell you that it is so. Come along, Doctor. Two to 1B Baker Street, Devitt.
Righto, Gov.
Blundering fool. Just to think of his having such an incomparable bit of good luck and not taking advantage of it.
Holmes, I'm rather in the dark still. It's true that the description of this man tallies with your idea of the second part in this mystery. But why should he come back to the house after leaving it?
The ring, ma'am, the ring. That was what he came back for. If we have no other way of catching him, we can always bait our line with the ring. I shall have him, Doctor. I lay you 2-1 that I have him. I must thank you for it all.
Me?
I might not have gone but for you. And so have missed the finest study I ever came across. A study in scarlet, eh? Yeah, why shouldn't we use a little art jargon? There's the scarlet thread of murder running through the colorless skein of life. And our duty is to unravel it and isolate it and expose every inch of it. What's the matter? You're not looking quite yourself. This Brixton Road affair has upset you.
Well, to tell the truth, it has. I ought to be more case-hardened after my Afghan experiences. I saw my own comrades hacked to pieces of my wand without losing my nerve, but I've gone over this business again and again this afternoon until I dozed off, that is.
I can understand. There's a mystery about this which stimulates the imagination. Where there's no imagination, there's no horror. Have you seen the evening paper?
No.
Give us a fairly good account of the affair. It doesn't mention the fact that when the man was raised up on the stretcher, a woman's wedding ring fell upon the floor.
Oh,
it's just as well it doesn't.
Why?
Look at this advertisement.
What?
I had one sent to every paper this morning immediately after the affair.
Where?
In the found column.
Yes. In Brixton Road this morning, a plain gold wedding ring found in the roadway between the White Hart Tavern and Holland Grove. Apply Dr. Watson, 221B Baker Street, between 8 and 9 this evening. Oh.
Excuse my using your name. If I used my own, some of these dunderheads would recognize it and want to meddle in the affair.
Oh, that's all right, but supposing anyone applies? I've no ring.
Oh, yes, you have.
Huh?
Here you are. This is almost a facsimile.
I say. But who do you expect will answer this advertisement?
Why, the man in the brown coat. Our florid friend with the square toes. If he doesn't come himself, he'll send an accomplice.
Wouldn't he consider it too dangerous?
Not at all. If my view of the case is correct, and I have every reason to believe that it is, this man would rather risk anything than lose the ring. According to my notion, he dropped it while stooping over Drebber's body and didn't miss it at the time.
Yeah.
After leaving the house, he discovered his loss and hurried back, but found the police already in possession owing to his own folly in leaving the candle burning. He had to pretend to be drunk in order to allay the suspicions which might have been aroused by his appearance at the gate.
I see.
Now, put yourself in that man's place. On thinking the matter over, it must have occurred to him that it was possible that he had lost the ring in the road after leaving the house. What would he do then? He would eagerly look out for the evening papers in the hope of seeing it among the articles found.
Yeah.
His eye, of course, would light upon this. He'd be overjoyed. Why should he fear a trap? There'd be no reason in his eyes why the finding of the ring should be connected with the murder. No. He would come. He will come. You shall see him within the hour.
And then?
Oh, you can leave me to deal with him then. By the way, have you any firearms?
Oh, I have my old service revolver and a few cartridges.
You'd better clean it and load it. He'll be a desperate man. And though I shall take him unawares, it's as well to be ready for anything.
Very well, then. I'll do it as soon as we've had dinner.
That was part one of A Study in Scarlet by Michael Hardwick from the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sherlock Holmes was played by Carlton Hobbs and Dr. Watson by Norman Shelley. Production for the BBC was by Norman Wright.
Capital, my dear Watson. Let us return to our humble abode.
221B Baker Street, please, cabby.
From London, we present the second episode of A Study in Scarlet, a play for radio in three parts by Michael Hardwick, based on the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Here is Dr. Watson to continue the story of A Study in Scarlet.
A Study in Scarlet was how my friend Mr. Sherlock Holmes had described our investigation into the murder of the American Enoch J. Drebber in an empty house near the Brixton Road. Certainly, my mind kept returning to the scarlet of that blood in which some unknown finger had dipped to write on a wall above the dead man the one word Rache, the German for revenge. Revenge for what? And by whom? So I mused, as I cleaned my old service revolver and waited with Holmes for the arrival of a claimant to the woman's wedding ring, which had been found near the body. Well, the old pistol seems none the worse for lying idle.
The plot thickens, Watson. I've just had an answer to the telegram I sent to America after we left Lauriston Gardens. My view of the case is the correct one.
And that is?
Oh, my fiddle would be the better for new strings. Put your pistol in your pocket.
You go on.
When the fellow comes, speak to him in an ordinary way. Leave the rest to me. Don't frighten him by looking at him too hard. He'll probably be here in a few minutes. Now, open the door slightly.
Very well.
That will do. Now put the key on the inside. Here comes our man, I think. Quickly with the key.
All right, very good.
Now, listen.
Good evening. Oh, Dr. Watson, will you just follow me?
Come in.
Yes, my good woman.
It's, this has brought me, good gentleman, here in the paper. A gold wedding ring in the Brixton Road. It belongs to my girl, Sally, as was married only this time 12 months, of which her husband is steward aboard a union boat. And what he'd say if he come home and found her without her ring is more than I can think, he being short enough at the best of times, but more especially when he has the drink. If it please you, she went to the circus last night along with...
Is that her ring?
Ah, the Lord be thanked. Sally will be a glad woman this night.
Yes. And what may your address be?
13 Duncan Street, Houndsditch. There's a weary way from here.
The Brixton Road doesn't lie between any circus and Houndsditch.
The gentleman asked me for my address. Sally lives in lodgings at 3 Mayfield Place, Peckham.
And your name is...
My name is Sawyer.
Sawyer?
Hers is Dennis, which Tom Dennis married her. And a smart, clean lad, too, as long as he's at sea. And no steward in the company more thought of. But when on shore, what with the women and the liquor shops...
Holmes,
give it to her.
Here's your ring, Mrs. Sawyer. It clearly belongs to your daughter. And I'm glad to be able to restore it to the rightful owner.
If he could have come home and found her without it, I don't know what he might have done. Thank you, good gentleman. Oh, my poor Sally, what will she say?
Good night to you, Mrs. Sawyer.
Good night to you, sir.
I'll follow her. She must be an accomplice. She'll lead me to it. Wait up for me, Watson. I wouldn't have the Scotland Yarders know it for the world, Watson.
Well,
they'd never let me hear the end of it.
Oh, what is it, Holmes? Where have you been? It's just gone midnight.
Oh, I don't mind telling a story against myself. That creature had gone a little way when she hailed a four-wheeler which was passing.
Yeah.
I managed to be close to her so as to hear the address. But I needn't have been so anxious, for she sang it out loud enough for it to be heard at the other side of the street.
Drive to 13 Duncan Street, Houndsditch,
she cried. This begins to look genuine, I thought. Mm-hmm. And having seen her safely inside, I perched myself behind.
You perched yourself?
Huh? Oh, that's an art which every detective should be an expert at. Well, away we rattled and never drew rein until we reached the street in question. I hopped off before we came to the door and strolled down the street in an easy, lounging way. I saw the cab pull up. The driver jumped down and I saw him open the door and stand expectantly. Nothing came out, though.
What?
When I reached him, he was groping about frantically in the empty cab and giving vent to the finest assorted collection of oaths that I ever listened to. There was no sign or trace of his passenger, and I fear it'll be some time before he gets his fare. On inquiring at number 13, we found that no one of the name either of Sawyer or Dennis had ever been heard of there.
But you don't mean to say that that tottering, feeble old woman was able to get out of the cab while it was in motion without either you or the driver seeing her?
Old woman be damned. We were the old women to be so taken in. It must have been a young man, and an active one, too, besides being an incomparable actor. The get-up was inimitable.
Yes, it was.
He saw that he was followed, no doubt, and used this means of giving me the slip. It shows that the man we're after is not as lonely as I imagined he was, but has friends who are ready to risk something for him. Now, Doctor, you're looking done up. As you say, it's gone midnight. Take my advice and turn in.
Yes, I think I will. You turning in, too?
Hmm? Oh, not yet a while, I fear. This smouldering fire and my violin will keep me company long into the watches of the night, I fancy.
Good night.
There's a strange problem still to unravel. A very strange problem indeed.
Well, Holmes, the papers are certainly full of it today. The Brixton Mystery, they're calling it.
Ah. But have they anything useful to tell us?
Well, as far as I can see, most of them are concentrating on the victim's German name.
That won't get us far.
Wait a minute. This must be a later edition. They've identified the man.
Have they, indeed? Well, in that case, my dear Watson, pray post me up while I demolish this poor thing.
Oh, very well, Holmes. The deceased was an American gentleman who had been residing for some weeks in the metropolis. He had stayed at the boarding house of Madame Charpentier in Torquay Terrace, Camberwell. He was accompanied in his travels by his private secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson. The two bade adieu to their landlady upon Tuesday the 4th inst and departed to Euston Station with the avowed intention of catching the Liverpool Express. They were afterwards seen together upon the platform. Nothing more is known of them until Mr. Drebber's body was, as recorded, discovered in an empty house in the Brixton Road, many miles from Euston. How he came there, or how... Oh, continued on page 4, column 3. He met his fate are questions which are still involved in mystery. Nothing is known of the whereabouts of Stangerson. We are glad to learn that Mr. Lestrade and Mr. Gregson of Scotland Yard are both engaged upon the case, and it is confidently anticipated that these well-known officers will speedily throw light upon the matter.
I told you that whatever happened, Lestrade and Gregson would be sure to score.
Oh, that depends on how it turns out.
Oh, bless you, it doesn't matter in the least. If a man is caught, it'll be on account of their exertions. If he escapes, it'll be in spite of their exertions. It's heads I win and tails you lose.
What on earth is that?
It's the Baker Street Division of the Detective Police Force.
The what?
Attention! Come along now, get into line quickly. In future, you will send up Wiggins alone to report, and the rest of you must wait in the street. Now, have you found it, Wiggins?
No, sir, we ain't.
I hardly expected you would. You must keep on until you do, though. Well, here are your wages. Now, off you go, and come back with a better report next time.
Yes, sir. Come on, all of you. Double march.
Now, Holmes, what on earth?
There's more work to be got out of one of those little beggars than out of a dozen of the force. The mere sight of an official-looking person seals men's lips. These youngsters, however, go everywhere and see everything. They're as sharp as needles, too. All they want is organization.
Are you employing them on this Brixton case, then?
Yes. There's a point which I wish to ascertain. It's merely a matter of time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Inspector Gregson, come in.
Mr. Holmes, congratulate me. I mean, the whole thing is clear as day.
You mean that you were on the right track?
The right track? Why, we have the man under lock and key.
And his name is?
Arthur Charpentier, a sub-lieutenant in Her Majesty's Navy.
Well, take a seat and try one of these cigars.
Thank you.
We're anxious to know how you managed it.
The fun of it is that that fool Lestrade, who thinks himself so smart, has gone off upon the wrong track altogether. He's after the secretary, Stangerson, who had no more to do with the crime than the babe unborn.
And how did you get your clue, Gregson?
Well, the first difficulty which we had to contend with was finding this American's antecedents. Some people would have waited until their advertisements were answered, or until parties came forward and volunteered information. But that's not Tobias Gregson's way of going to work. You remember the hat beside the dead man?
Yes, by John Underwood and Sons, 129 Camberwell Road.
Oh, I'd no idea you'd notice that. Well, anyway, my belief is you should never neglect a chance, however small it may seem.
To a great mind, nothing is little.
Quite, yes. Well, I went to Underwood and asked him if he'd sold a hat of that size and description. He looked over his books and came on it at once. He had sent a hat to Mr. Drebber, residing at Charpentier's boarding establishment, Torquay Terrace. Thus, I got at his address.
Smart. Very smart.
I next called upon Madame Charpentier. I found her very pale and distressed. Her daughter was in the room, too, an uncommonly fine girl she is, I may add. She was looking red about the eyes, and her lips trembled as I spoke to her. That didn't escape my notice. You know the feeling, Mr. Holmes, when you come upon the right scent. A kind of thrill in your nerves. Before I even started to question them, I felt that these people knew something about the matter. Now, ladies, have you heard of the mysterious death of your late boarder, Mr. Enoch J. Drebber of Cleveland?
Oh, there, there, now, dear.
Yes, sir, we have heard about it.
At what o'clock did Mr. Drebber leave your house for the train?
At 8 o'clock. His secretary, Mr. Sanderson, said there were two trains, one at 9:15 and one at 11. He was to catch the first.
And that was the last you saw of him? Madam, I asked whether it was the last you saw of
him. Yes. Yes, it was.
Oh, Mother. Mother, no good can ever come of falsehood. We did see Mr. Drebber again, sir.
God forgive you. You've murdered your brother.
But Arthur would rather we spoke the truth.
You'd best tell me all about it. Half confidences are worse than none. Besides, you don't know how much we know already.
Oh, on your head be it, Alice. Perhaps you'd better leave us together.
Yes, Mother.
Now, sir, I had no intention of telling you all this, but since my poor daughter disclosed it, I have no alternative. Having once decided to speak, I will tell you all without omitting any particular.
It's your wisest course, madam. Yeah.
Mr. Drebber had been with us nearly 3 weeks. He and his secretary, Mr. Stangerson, had been traveling on the continent.
Yes.
Mr. Stangerson was a quiet, reserved man. Oh, but his employer, I'm sorry to say, was far otherwise. He was coarse in his habits and brutish in his ways.
How so?
But the very night of his arrival, he became very much the worse for drink. And indeed, after 12 o'clock in the daytime, he could hardly ever be said to be sober. But his manner towards the maidservant was disgustingly free and familiar. And worst of all, he assumed the same attitude towards my daughter and spoke to her more than once in a way which, fortunately, she's too innocent to understand. But on one occasion, he actually seized her in his arms and embraced her. Oh, his own secretary reproached him for it.
But why did you stand all this? I suppose you can get rid of your boarders when you wish.
I would to God that I'd given him notice on the very day he came. But it was a sore temptation. They were paying £1 a day each, and this is the slack season. And I am a widow, and my boy in the Navy has cost me much. I acted for the best. This last was too much, however, and I gave him notice to leave on account of it.
I see.
Oh, my heart grew light as I saw him drive away. My son is on leave just now, but I did not tell him anything of all this. His temper is violent, and he's passionately fond of his sister. Well, when I closed the door behind them, a load seemed to be lifted from my mind.
Yeah.
Alas, in less than an hour, there was a ring at the bell, and I learned that Mr. Drebber had returned. He was the worse for drink. He forced his way into the room where I was sitting with my daughter and made some incoherent remark about having missed his train. He then turned to Alice and before my very face proposed to her that she should fly with him. You are of age, he said, and there's no law to stop you. I have money and enough to spare. Never mind the old girl here, but come along with me now straight away. You shall live like a princess.
Go on.
Poor Alice was so frightened that she shrank away from him, but he caught her by the wrist. Well, I screamed, and at that moment my son Arthur came into the room. What happened then? I do not know. I heard oaths and confused sounds of a scuffle. I was too terrified to raise my head. And when I did look up, I saw Arthur standing in the doorway laughing, with a stick in his hand. I don't think that fine fellow will trouble us again, he said. I will just go after him and see what it does with himself. And with those words, he took his hat and started off down the street. The next morning, we heard of Mr. Drebber's mysterious death.
Madame Charpentier, at what hour did your son return?
I do not know. He has a latchkey and he let himself in.
After you went to bed?
Yes.
When did you go to bed?
About 11.
So your son was gone at least 2 hours?
Yes.
Possibly 4 or 5?
Yes.
What was he doing during that time?
I do not know, sir. I do not know.
after that, there was nothing more to be done. I found out where Lieutenant Charpentier was and arrested him. When I touched him on the shoulder and warned him to come quietly with us, he answered us as bold as brass, "I suppose you are arresting me for being concerned in the death of that scoundrel Drebber." We said nothing to him about it, so that his alluding to it had a most suspicious aspect.
Very.
He still carried the heavy stick which the mother described as having with him when he followed Drebber.
What's your theory, then, Inspector Gregson?
Well, Mr. Holmes, my theory is that he followed Drebber as far as the Brixton Road. When there, some occasion arose between them, and in the course of which, Drebber received a blow from the stick in the pit of the stomach, perhaps, which killed him without leaving any mark. The night was so wet that no one was about, so Charpentier dragged the body of his victim into the empty house. As to the candle and the blood and the writing on the wall and the ring, they may all have been so many tricks to throw the police onto the wrong scent.
Well done. Really, Gregson, you're getting along. We shall make something of you yet.
Well, I flatter myself that I've managed it rather neatly. The young man volunteered a statement in which he said that after following Drebber for some time, the latter perceived him and took a cab in order to get away from him. On his way home, Charpentier... Yes, I think the whole case fits together uncommonly well. What amuses me is to think of Lestrade, who had started off upon the wrong scent. I really won't make much of it.
Why, by Jove, here's the very man himself. Come in, Inspector Lestrade.
Oh, so you're here, Gregson.
I suppose, Lestrade, you've come to consult Mr. Sherlock Holmes. Ask him what move to make next, eh?
Well, I don't mind admitting this is a most extraordinary case, most incomprehensible affair.
Ah, you find it so? I thought you'd come to that conclusion. Have you managed to land the secretary, Mr. Joseph Stangerson?
I've just come from Stangerson's room.
We've been hearing Gregson's view of the matter. Would you mind letting us know what you have done, Lestrade?
No, Mr. Holmes, no objections at all. I freely confess that I was of the opinion that Stangerson was concerned in the death of Drebber.
Was?
A fresh development has shown me that I was completely mistaken.
Well, well.
I fancy we'd better take the events in their sequence.
Very well. Full of the one idea, I set myself to discover what had become of the secretary. He and Drebber had been seen together at Euston Station about 8:30 on the evening of the 3rd. At 2 in the morning of the 4th, Drebber had been found murdered in the house off Brixton Road. The question which confronted me was to find out how Stangerson had been employed between 8:30 and the time of the crime and what had become of him afterwards. I telegraphed to Liverpool, giving a description of the man and warning them to keep a watch upon the American boats. I then set to work calling upon all the hotels and lodging houses in the vicinity of Euston. You see, I argued that if Drebber and his companion had become separated that evening, the natural course for Stangerson would be to put up somewhere in the vicinity for the night, then to hang about the station again next morning to look out for his employer.
They'd be likely to agree on some meeting place beforehand.
Yes, so it proved. I spent the whole of yesterday evening making inquiries entirely without avail. This morning, I began very early, and at 8:00, I reached Halliday's private hotel in Little George Street.
Good morning, sir. Can I help you?
Yes, I'd like to know whether a Mr. Stangerson is living here.
Oh, certainly, sir. No doubt you're the gentleman he was expecting. He's been waiting here for a gentleman for 2 days.
Where is he now?
He's upstairs in bed. He wished to be called at 9.
Well, I'll go up and see him at once, then.
Yes, sir. The Boots will take you. Boots?
Yes? Morning, sir.
Right. Take this gentleman up to Mr. Stangerson's room.
Yes, would you follow me, sir? There's his room, sir, just along here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Cool.
What's that? It looks like blood. Coming from under his door.
Oh, you're right.
It's locked, sir.
Well, stand out of the way while I put the shoulders with.
Yeah, but, sir,
get it back.
Cool. I can't stay in here. Let me pass, Gov. Let me pass.
Stangerson has been stabbed to the heart. Dead for some time. He bled profusely. But now comes the strangest part of the affair, Mr. Holmes. What do you suppose was on the wall?
The word Rache, written in letters of blood.
Well, that was it.
Great heaven.
Get on with the details, Lestrade.
Well, the murderer was seen. A milk boy happened to walk down the lane at the back of the hotel. He noticed that a ladder, which usually lay there, was raised against one of the windows on the second floor, which was wide open. He looked back and saw a man descend the ladder. He came down so openly that the lad imagined him to be some carpenter or joiner at work. Took no notice beyond thinking it was early for anyone like that to be at work. And he has an impression that the man was tall, had a reddish face, and was dressed in a long brownish coat.
Did you find anything in the room which could furnish a clue to the murderer?
Nothing. Stangerson had 80-odd pounds in his pocket. Whatever the motive for these two crimes, it certainly wasn't robbery. There were no papers in the pockets, except a telegram, dated from Cleveland about a month ago, containing the words, J.H. is in Europe. There was no sender's name.
And there was nothing else?
Nothing of any importance. His pipe was on the chair beside the bed. There was a glass of water on the table. And on the windowsill, a small chip ointment box containing a couple of pills.
What? At last!
What's that, Mr. Holmes?
The last link. My case is complete.
Oh, but just what do you mean, Mr. Holmes?
I have now in my hands all the threads which have formed such a tangle. There are, of course, details to be filled in, but I'm as certain of all the main facts from the time that Drebber parted from Stangerson at the station up to the discovery of Stangerson's body as if I'd seen them with my own eyes. I'll give you proof of my knowledge. Could you lay your hand upon it?
Yes, I have them here. Don't attach any importance to them, though.
Let me see them. Doctor, Are those ordinary pills?
No, they're certainly not. Pearly grey colour, small, round, and, let's see. Yes, almost transparent against the light. From their lightness and transparency, I should imagine they're soluble in water.
Precisely, sir. Now, would you mind going down and fetching that poor little devil of a terrier which has been bad so long and which the landlady wanted you to put out of its pain yesterday?
Oh, yes, it will, Holmes.
What are you going to do, Mr. Holmes?
I will now cut one of these pills in two. One half we return into the box for future purposes. The other half I will place in this wine glass. If you'd be kind enough to pass me the carafe, Lestrade.
Yes, here you are.
Thank you. Now then, I pour into the glass a teaspoonful of water. Ah. You perceive that our friend the doctor is right. The pill readily dissolves. I shall now add a little milk to make the mixture palatable.
Here he is, poor old chap. Long past his allotted span, I'm afraid.
Put him down on a cushion while I transfer this mixture to a saucer.
Right.
Now, poor old boy, here's a little drink for you.
Well?
It can't be a coincidence. The very pills which I suspected in the case of Drebber are actually found after the death of Stangerson, and yet they're inert. What can it mean? Oh, surely my whole chain of reasoning cannot have been false. No, it's impossible. And yet this wretched dog is none the worse.
Well, if you ask me...
Wait. I have it. Where's that other pill?
Here you are.
Cut it in two for me while I get more milk and water ready.
Done.
Now, in it goes.
You mean you're going to try again?
Precisely. Now, boy, try another saucer.
That was part two of A Study in Scarlet by Michael Hardwick from the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sherlock Holmes was played by Carlton Hobbs and Dr. Watson by Norman Shelley. Production for the BBC was by Norman Wright.
Cabby!
Capital, my dear Watson. Let us return to our humble abode.
221B Baker Street, please, cabby.
From London, we present the final episode of A Study in Scarlet, a play for radio in three parts by Michael Hardwick, based on the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Here is Dr. Watson to continue the story of A Study in Scarlet.
Inspector Gregson of Scotland Yard had been crying over his colleague Lestrade. While he, Gregson, had acted so decisively in arresting young Arthur Charpentier for the murder of Enoch Drebber, Lestrade, with the mere duty of questioning Stangerson, the dead man's secretary, had returned to 221B Baker Street with failure written all over his face. But then Holmes and I had been as astonished as Gregson to hear that he had found Stangerson murdered too. Lestrade had brought a box containing two pills, which he had found near the body. Exclaiming that at last his case was complete, Holmes wasted no time in feeding one to the poor aging dog which our landlady had asked us that morning to have destroyed. To his dismay, the effect was nil. With his whole case hanging upon the consequences, Holmes proceeded to grind the only remaining pill into some milk and watched anxiously as the dog drank.
Poor old chap.
He worked.
I should have had more faith. I ought to know by this time that when a fact appears to be opposed to a long train of deductions, it invariably proves to be capable of bearing some other interpretation. Of the two pills in that box, one was of the most deadly poison and the other was entirely harmless. I ought to have known that before ever I saw the box at all.
Well, I don't like saying it in front of you, Gregson, but I'm right out of my depth. I really am.
You're not alone, Lestrade. Now, look here, Mr. Holmes. We want something more than mere theory and preaching now. It's a case of taking the man. I made my case out, and it seems that I was wrong. Young Charpentier is locked up and couldn't have been engaged in this second affair. Lestrade went after his man, Stangerson, and it appears that he's wrong, too. Now, can you name the man who did it?
Can't help feeling that Gregson's right, sir.
Holmes, if I may say so, any delay in arresting the murderer might give him time to perpetrate some fresh atrocity.
There'll be no more murders. You've asked me if I know the name of the murderer. I do.
What?
The mere knowing of his name is a small thing, however, compared with the power of laying our hands upon him. This I expect very shortly to do.
But how?
I have good hopes of managing it through my own arrangements, but it's a thing which needs delicate handling. We have a shrewd and desperate man to deal with. As long as this man has no idea that anyone can have a clue, there's some chance of securing him. But if he has the slightest suspicion, he'd change his name and vanish in an instant among the 4 million inhabitants of this great city. Without meaning to hurt either of your feelings, I'm bound to say that I consider him to be more than a match for the official force. And that is why I have not asked your assistance.
Now look here.
If I fail, I shall, of course, incur all the blame due to this omission. But that I'm prepared for. At present, I'm ready to promise that the instant I can communicate with you without endangering my own arrangements, I shall do so.
Well, I don't know about that.
Would you...
Sir, please, sir.
What the...
Yes, Wiggins?
I've got the cab downstairs, sir.
Good boy. Lestrade, Gregson.
Yes?
Why don't you introduce this pattern of handcuffs at Scotland Yard? See how beautifully the spring works. They fasten in an instant.
The old pattern's good enough if we can only find a man to put them on.
Yeah.
Very good, very good. The cabman may as well help me with my boxes. Just ask him to step up, Wiggins.
Yes, sir.
Holmes, you never said anything about setting out on a journey.
Nor I did, Watson. However, I must just get this small portmanteau ready.
What is this, Mr. Holmes?
Yes, Holmes, I really think you ought to... Oh, not been used for so long, these... Buckles are dreadfully difficult.
Here, let me help you.
No, the cabman can do it.
Mm?
Ah, there you are, my good man.
Yes, governor.
Just give me a hand with this buckle, if you please.
Mm. All right, sir.
What? What's that?
Oh, be still.
Gentlemen, let me introduce you to Mr. Jefferson Hope, the murderer of Enoch Greber and Joseph Stangerson.
Good, Jim.
We have his cab. It will serve to take him to Scotland Yard.
Jefferson Hope, I arrest... I think, Mr. Lestrade, in view of my seniority of service...
Oh, very well.
Jefferson Hope, I arrest you in the Queen's name for the murders of Enoch Greber and Joseph Stangerson. And I must caution you that anything you say will be taken down and may be put in evidence.
I've got a good deal to say. I want to tell you gentlemen all about it. If there's a vacant place for a chief of the police, I reckon you're the man for it, sir.
Never mind about that.
Oh, no, I mean it. The way you kept on my trail was a caution.
Well, hadn't you better reserve that for your trial?
I may never be tried.
Well, look here.
You needn't look so startled. It isn't suicide I'm thinking of. You're a doctor, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Then put your hand here on my chest.
Well, as you wish.
Well...
Why, this man has an aortic aneurysm.
Yes, that's what they call it. I went to a doctor last week about it, and he told me it is bound to burst before many days have passed. Mm-hmm. It has been getting worse for years. I got it from overexposure and underfeeding among the Salt Lake Mountains. I've done my work now, and I don't care how soon I go. But I should like to leave some account of the business behind me. I don't want to be remembered as a common murderer.
Dr. Watson.
Yes, Inspector?
Do you consider there is immediate danger?
Most certainly there is.
In that case, it's clearly our duty in the interest of justice to take his statement. Will you write it down, please, Mr. Lestrade?
All right.
I have cautioned you, and you are at liberty to give your account, which this officer will take down.
I understand. I'll sit down with your leave.
By all means.
Thank you. This aneurysm of mine makes me easily tired, and that tussle we had just now hasn't mended matters. I am on the brink of the grave, and I'm not likely to lie to you, gentlemen.
Right. I'm ready.
Proceed, then.
It doesn't much matter to you why I hated those two men. It's enough that they were guilty of the death of two human beings, a father and a daughter, and that they had, therefore, forfeited their own lives. That girl was to have married me in America 20 years ago. She was forced into marrying that same Drebber and broke her heart over it. I took the marriage ring from her dead finger and I vowed that his dying eyes should rest upon that very ring and that his last thought should be of the crime for which he was punished. I have carried it about with me and followed him and his accomplice over two continents until I caught them. If I die tomorrow, as is likely enough, I die knowing that my work in this world is done, and well done.
Yes, yes, get on.
When I got to London, my pocket was about empty, and I found that I must turn my hand to something for my living. Driving and riding are as natural to me as walking. So I applied at a cab owner's office and soon got employment. It was some time before I found out where my two gentlemen were living. They were at a boarding house at Camberwell, over on the other side of the river. I had grown my beard, and there was no chance of their recognizing me. Go where they would about London, I was always at their heels. At last, one evening, I was driving up and down Torquay Terrace when I saw a cab draw up at their door. Presently, some luggage was brought out. Time, Drebber and Stangerson followed it and drove off. I whipped up my horse and kept within sight of them, feeling very ill at ease, for I feared that they were going to shift their quarters. At Euston Station, they got out, and I left a boy to hold my horse and followed them onto the platform. I got near enough to hear what they were saying.
But I tell you, there isn't another Liverpool train for hours.
So who cares?
I care. The sooner we're on a train to Liverpool and getting out of here, the happier I'll be.
Well, Stangerson, we'll just have to wait, won't we? Now, come to think of it, I've a little business of my own to do. Now, if you just hang around here someplace, I'll go off and I'll join you later.
Like hell. You swore we'd always stick together. If you go, I'm going with you.
Well, you see, this little matter's kind of delicate. You'd be in the way.
Is that so? Well, either I go with you or we both stay here. You can take it or leave it, Drebber.
Look here, Stangerson. It's about time you remembered you're nothing more than a paid servant around here. Who the hell do you think you are trying to dictate to me?
I didn't mean it that way.
Well, that's how it sounded to me. Now cut it out once and for all.
Okay, then. But look, supposing you're not back in time for the train. It's the last one tonight.
Oh, I'll be back here before 11. Tell you what, if I'm not, we'll meet up again at Halliday's Hotel. That suit you?
I guess it'll have to.
The moment for which I had waited so long had come at last. My plans were already formed. It chanced that some days before, a gentleman who had been looking over some empty houses off the Brixton Road had dropped a key of one of them in my carriage. How to get Drebber to that house was the problem. There was a hansom in front of mine, and he hailed it. I followed it for miles, until to my astonishment, we found ourselves back in the terrace where he had boarded. I went on and pulled up my cab 100 yards or so from the house. He entered it, and his hansom drove away. Well, I waited for a quarter of an hour or more, when suddenly there came a noise like people struggling inside the house. Next moment, the door was flung open, and 2 men appeared. One of them was Drebber, and the other was a young chap whom I had never seen before.
You filthy hound! I'll teach you to insult an honest girl!
Get your hands off me!
If you're not out of this road inside 10 seconds, I'll lay this cudgel across you so you won't be able to walk! Now, get on with you!
Okay, I'm going. Hey, you! Debbie!
Yes, Gardner?
Drive me to Halliday's private hotel.
When I had him fairly inside my cab, my heart jumped so much with joy that I feared lest at this last moment my aneurysm might go wrong. I was once janitor and sweeper out of a laboratory in the States. One day, a professor was lecturing on some alkaloid which was so powerful that the least grain meant instant death. When they were all gone, I helped myself to a little of it. I was a fairly good dispenser, so I worked this alkaloid into small soluble pills, and each pill I put in a box with a similar pill made without the poison. I determined that when I had my chance, my gentlemen should each have a draw out of one of those boxes while I ate the pill that remained. From that day, I had always my pill boxes about with me, and the time had now come when I was to use them. It was nearer 1 than 12, and a wild, bleak night blowing hard. My hands were trembling and my temples throbbing with excitement. There was not a soul to be seen. When I looked in at the cab window, I found Drebber huddled in a drunken sleep.
Come on, there. Come on, wake up. Wake up, I say.
What's the matter?
It's time to get out.
All right, cabby.
Now, you better follow me, sir.
Is this the hotel? Halliday's?
Oh, come along now, sir. I'll help you.
It's infernally dark. Say, what kind of a hotel is this?
We'll soon have a light. Just light this candle. There. Now, Enoch Drebber, who am I?
Who? What do you mean? I don't... No. No!
Yes, you dog. I have hunted you from Salt Lake City to St. Petersburg, and you've always escaped me. But now your wanderings have come to an end.
No. No, Keep away from me.
What do you think of poor Lucy Ferrier now? Punishment has been slow in coming, but it has overtaken you at last.
What? Would you murder me?
Who talks of murdering a mad dog? What mercy had you upon my poor darling when you dragged her from her slaughtered father and bore her away?
Wasn't I killed her father?
But it was you who broke her innocent heart. Let the high God judge between us. You see this box?
What is it? What are they?
They're just a couple of pills. Choose and eat. There is death in one and life in the other. I shall take what you leave. Let us see if there is justice upon the earth, or if we are ruled by chance.
Poisoned? We are mad. I won't do it.
Oh, yes, you will, with my knife at your throat. Choose and eat. This way, you have a 50-50 chance. If you don't take it, it'll be my knife and no chance for you at all.
Very well. I'll eat.
Now, I'll take the other. And we shall see.
It doesn't taste. You've got it. You must... You...
I turned him over with my foot and placed my hand upon his heart. There was no movement. He was dead. The pulses in my temples were beating like sledgehammers, and I believe I would have had a fit of some sort if the blood had not gushed from my nose and relieved me. I remembered a German being found in New York with rash written up above him, and it was argued that the secret societies must have done it. I guessed that what puzzled the New Yorkers would puzzle Londoners, so I dipped my finger in my own blood and printed it on the wall. And then I walked down to my cab. I had driven some distance when I put my hand into the pocket in which I usually kept Lucy's ring and found it was not there. It was the only memento I had of her. Thinking that I might have dropped it when I stooped over Drebber's body, I drove back, and leaving my cab on a side street, I went boldly up to the house. I walked right into the arms of a police officer who was coming out. I managed to fool him by pretending to be hopelessly drunk, but I had to go away without that ring.
So much for Drebber, then. How about Stangerson?
Oh, I knew that he was staying at Halliday's Hotel. Early next morning, I took advantage of some ladders which were lying in the lane behind the hotel and so made my way into his room in the gray of the dawn. I woke him up and told him he was to answer for the life he had taken so long before. I gave him the same choice of poisoned pills. But he sprang from his bed and flew at my throat. In self-defense, I stabbed him to the heart.
I see. You got all that, Mr. Lestrade?
Every word.
Well, is there anything you'd like to ask, Mr. Holmes?
There's only one point on which I should like a little more information. Who was your accomplice who came for the ring which I advertised?
Oh, I can tell you my own secrets, but I don't get other people into trouble. He had no hand in the deaths of those two men and knows nothing of them.
I think we can accept the truth of that, Gregson.
Very well, Mr. Holmes. But now, gentlemen, the forms of the law must be complied with. On Thursday, the prisoner will be brought before the magistrates and your attendance will be required.
That's understood, Inspector.
Until then, I will be responsible for him. Come along, if you please, Mr. Lestrade. We may as well use his own cab. But I'm afraid we can hardly let him drive it. You'll have to oblige.
Oh, never mind. At least I can drive a cab.
Come along, Hope. Let's be moving.
My dear Watson, Gregson and Lestrade will be furious about his death.
Well, it was better for the poor devil to die in his cell than on the scaffold.
His life was hanging by a thread.
I fancy they won't see it that way. Where will their grand advertisement be now?
How they must have been looking forward to the trial. I must admit it would have been pretty interesting.
Never mind. I wouldn't have missed the investigation for anything. There's been no better case within my recollection. Simple as it was.
Simple?
Now let me see if I can make it clearer. Now, this was a case in which you were given the results and had to find everything else for yourself.
I approached the house with my mind entirely free from all impressions. I began by examining the roadway, and there, as I've already explained to you, I saw clearly the marks of a cab, which, as I ascertained by inquiry, must have been there during the night.
Yes, but just a moment. How could you know it was a cab and not a private carriage?
By the narrow gauge of the wheels. The ordinary London growler is considerably less wide than a gentleman's brougham.
Ah.
I then walked slowly down the garden path, which happened to be composed of a clay soil, peculiarly suitable for taking impressions. There's no branch of detective science which is so important and so much neglected as the art of tracing footsteps. I saw the heavy footmarks of the constables, but I saw also the track of the two men who had first passed through the garden. It was easy to tell that they had been before the others because in places their marks had been entirely obliterated by the others coming upon the top of them.
I see, yeah.
In this way, my second link was formed, which told me that the nocturnal visitors were two in number, one remarkable for his height, as I calculated from the length of his stride, and the other fashionably dressed, to judge from the small and elegant impression left by his boots.
What next?
On entering the house, this last inference was confirmed. My well-booted man lay dead before me. The taller one, then, had done the murder, if murder there was. Having sniffed the dead man's lips, I detected a slightly sour smell, and I came to the conclusion that he'd been poisoned.
Mm.
I argued from the hatred and fear expressed upon his face that the poison had been forced upon him. And now came the great question as to the reason why. Robbery had not been the object of the murder, for nothing was taken. Political assassins, on the other hand, are only too glad to do their work and to fly. This murder had been done most deliberately, and the perpetrator had left his tracks all over the room.
And the inscription on the wall?
Was too obviously a blind. No, it must have been a private wrong, and not a political one, which called for such a methodical revenge. I was inclined from the first to suspect that a woman was in some way connected with it.
Ah, and finding the wedding ring...
That settled the question. However, I proceeded to make a careful examination of the room, which confirmed me in my opinion as to the murderer's height and furnished me with the additional details as to the Trichinopoly cigar. I had already come to the conclusion, since there were no signs of a struggle, that the blood which covered the floor had burst from the murderer's nose in his excitement.
Oh, yes.
I could see that the track of blood coincided with the track of his feet. Now, as a medical man, Watson, you will agree that it is seldom that any man breaks out in such a way through emotion unless he's very full-blooded.
Yes, quite true.
So I hazarded the opinion that the criminal was a robust and ruddy-faced man.
Yes, indeed he was.
Quite so. Now, you will remember that I ascertained that when Griggs... He had not inquired as to any particular point which might appear to be critical.
Yes.
Well, having left the house, I telegraphed to the head of the police of Cleveland, limiting my inquiry of the circumstances connected with the marriage of Enoch J. Drebber.
Yes.
The answer was conclusive. It told me that Drebber had already applied for the protection of the law against an old rival in love named Jefferson Hope, and that this same Hope was at present in Europe. I knew now that I held the clue to the mystery in my hand, and all that remained was to secure the murderer.
All that remained?
Oh, it wasn't so difficult. I had already determined in my own mind that the man who had walked into the house with Drebber was none other than the man who had driven the cab.
Mm-hmm.
The marks in the road showed me that the horse had wandered on in a way which would have been impossible had there been anyone in charge of it. Where then could the driver be unless he were inside the house? And, my dear Watson, supposing one man wished to dog another through London, what better means could he adopt than to turn cab driver?
So you came to the conclusion that Jefferson Hope was to be found among the Jarvis of the metropolis. Oh, it's brilliant. Quite brilliant.
Thank you, Watson.
But what made you assume that having achieved his object, Jefferson Hope would go on being a cabbie?
Why, he would have been foolish not to. Any sudden change on his part might have drawn attention to himself. I therefore organized my street Arab detective corps and sent them systematically to every cab proprietor in London until they ferreted out the man I wanted.
Well, they certainly succeeded. But, Holmes, how about the murder of the other man, Stangerson?
Ah, that incident was entirely unexpected. Through it, I came into possession of the pills, the existence of which I had already surmised. You see, the whole thing is a chain of logical sequences without a break or flaw.
It's wonderful. It's remarkable. You should be publicly recognized for this, Holmes.
Oh,
You should publish an account of the case.
Oh, no.
Well, if you won't, I'll do it for you. I have all the facts in my journal. The public shall know them.
You may do what you like, Doctor.
Hello?
Yes, Mrs. Hudson.
The echo's just come, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, just throw it down there, Mrs. Hudson. I'll look at it later.
No, I'll have it, please.
Oh, very good, sir.
Thank you.
Shall you be in to lunch, gentlemen?
I fancy we shall.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mrs. Hudson. I say, listen to this, Holmes. The public have lost a sensational treat through the sudden death of the man Hope, who was suspected of the murders of Mr. Enoch Drebber and Mr. Joseph Stangerson. The details of the case will probably never now be known, though we are informed upon good authority that the crimes were the result of an old-standing and romantic feud. If the case has no other effect, it at least brings out in the most striking manner the efficiency of our detective police force. It is an open secret that the credit for this smart capture belongs entirely to the well-known Scotland Yard officials, Messrs. Gregson and Lestrade. It is expected that a testimonial of some sort will be presented to these two officers as a fitting recognition of their services. Well, Holmes, what about that?
Didn't I tell you so when we started, Watson? That's the result of all our study in Scarlet. To get them a testimonial.
That was part three of A Study in Scarlet by Michael Hardwick from the novel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Sherlock Holmes was played by Carlton Hobbs, Dr. Watson by Norman Shelley, Inspector Gregson by Humphrey Morton, Inspector Lestrade by Godfrey Kenton, and Jefferson Hope by Stuart Nicol. Production for the BBC was by Norman Wright.